Today is Monday, August 7th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Ann Lundeen, professor in the School of Library and Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Sandy.
The first questions have to do with your early life, where and when you were born. If you could talk about your childhood, your parents, if you have any brothers or sisters, where you went to elementary school and high school, and were there any people in your life when you were very young that influenced you on your career?
Okay, I'll do my best. I tend to have a kind of skimpy memory of my childhood. I think I was sort of, in my sense, I kind of grew up in, I guess, the classic term is dysfunctional family. And I think that to kind of survive, I forgot a lot of things. And unfortunately, when you go back to try to change that later and try to recover some of the good memories of your childhood and others, there tends to be just this broad brush that that has covered it all. So every now and then I have just a little glimmer of memory, but I will do my best with that. But I know some things just because I know them as facts in my life. I was born in 44. My parents, both of whom had the same last name, Hutchison, which was unusual, Scottish name. My father, I was born in New Jersey, and my mother was living really near my grandparents, in a little town in New Jersey, Mendham. And my father had taken a job with the YMCA, and he was in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that as soon as possible, we would join him. I had a sister 2 years older than I, Marcy, and so at a certain point when my mom was able to travel with me, I don't know how many months old I was, but we traveled over, we took one of the first commercial ships that were traveling right after the war from New York over to Cairo. Uh-huh. And my mother, poor dear, had to deal with us on this ship, and my sister, she said, was, you know, 2 years old and very frisky, and she had to be on the guard all the time. And I don't remember any of the Egypt, although I've always seen pictures of myself. I think at one point somebody's holding me on a camel, and there's the pyramids in the background and stuff, and so that was kind of neat. I think that I had a nanny when I was there who kind of took care of me. And I tried to find out if she was some wonderful person, because I'm so into the early formation of yourself through the people who are your caregivers. And she said, no, she wasn't anybody special. So anyway. Then when we got back, when we returned, we were there 2 years, and then we went to Pittsburgh, and then we started a series. My father was a Presbyterian minister, and we started a series of living someplace for 3 to 5 years, and all the rest of my childhood was that, where we moved a lot. Part of it that was that my father kind of always thought, you know, grass was greener, but also he had a kind of contentious personality, and so as a minister that often didn't go over very well, and he would make enemies in churches and so on. And so he actually, only one place did he have a church, and he was an assistant, and that was in Pittsburgh, and that was this big Presbyterian church right in downtown, in a really nice section of Pittsburgh, Shady Side. And I can remember just how nice it was to feel like there was a whole church there, and people were interested in our lives. And I was able to go to a really nice private girls' school because of his working there, and so on. It was kind of, I think, was sort of a ritzy church. But then he lost that job or was pushed on, and so then we moved to Connecticut, and we lived in a couple of different places in Connecticut. And then the first job he worked for was with a city council of churches in Bridgeport. And then we lived in Bridgeport and Fairfield, and then moved to New Jersey. And then from sixth grade through high school, which I guess is more than 5 years, maybe 6 years, we lived in Ridgewood, New Jersey, which was northern Bergen County, sort of a commuting suburb to New York. And my father was working in New York then for Church World Service, which was part of the National Council of Churches. So I think I got a good education. I think my folks were always mindful of the communities they picked in terms of the schools that we were in. I feel like I got a good education, although I think because of family problems that I was never really encouraged to develop any outside interests. And my sister was very outgoing and into lots and lots of activities. And I think I sort of, through sibling rivalry, took the opposite route and just kind of was a little bit more distant from things. And also, I didn't feel like I had any talents in the world at all. And So I would try something, and if it was hard, which most things are when you first try them,
right.
I would give up, or my mother would say, look, don't worry, you don't have to do that, that's fine. And so I always had this out, because I knew my mother would always say that. And so the only thing that I remember a little bit, and this was only, I only remembered this years later, was that I was a writer. And that I wrote stories about this character who was loosely based on Eloise. The story of the mischievous girl in living in the Waldorf Astoria. And I think that was the hotel. And actually that the stories were not about Eloise, which would have made a little more sense for me to be writing, but they were about her nanny. And I thought that was kind of interesting that when I chose a character, I chose a real mothering kind of character. And her name was Madame Usha, and I don't remember what happened to the stories, and I realized that because we moved so much that, and also I don't think my mother ever was the sentimental type, like, oh, we got to be sure to keep all your stuff. So I think everything got lost, and I actually totally forgot about it. And all the rest of my high school years and whatever, and even into college, I never felt that I was creative at all. So I'd really lost touch with myself as a writer. And in college, and in high school again, no real strong activities other than just my friends.
Remember any teachers?
One or two, but I don't remember their names. And we moved from there. My parents got divorced right after high school, and so I lost. You know, I never ever have been back, so I've never kept up with anybody there. So I just remembered that there was an English teacher and a history teacher and that I liked, and then that about my junior year I started to get more serious as a student and really working hard.
You knew you were going to college?
Oh yeah, uh-huh. I knew I was going to college, and my sister had gone to Smith on a scholarship, and I definitely did not see myself in that field, in that area. So in fact, for a long time, I thought I was going to go to a junior college and become like an executive secretary in New York, that or a nurse. I was kind of interested in being a nurse, but then one summer I did the volunteering in a hospital, and I realized it wasn't for me, and also I was very weak in the sciences. I really think to this day that I had a learning disability growing up, because I was very, very weak in math and science. And that was a time when, you might remember, women weren't really encouraged to, you didn't have to be good at that. And, but I also really think that since I still have spatial difficulties and problems with numbers, that I probably did have something. But I don't think at that time in the 50s they were really aware of learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I coped as well as I could, but those were always my lowest grades, anything to do with math or science. So that sort of left out nursing. And I remember just vaguely that I used to teach my dolls. I remember having a big blanket out and having my dolls there. And so I think that, and also I came from a family where there was a lot of teachers and preachers, so teaching was something that was there.
Did your mother have a career?
Just a little tiny one. She went to college. She went to Syracuse. Mm-hmm. She was an art major, and when she got out, she couldn't find a job. I don't think she was trained to be an art teacher as such. And she just started getting, she went back home to New Jersey and then got jobs in New York City as a secretary. And she did that until she married my father. She married my father probably in her mid-20s. And I always felt that she should have had a career, because I felt like that because she had an unhappy marriage, she dwelled too much on my sister and me, that it would have been much better if she had had something else. And to this day, she's 90 and she's full of energy and has a great business sense and so on. And she probably would have been a great businesswoman. And perhaps an artist, although she really just dropped the art, and I'm not sure exactly why. I have a few things around that she did as an artist, but that was way back when, and she basically didn't ever do anything more with it. And I think it was partly that my father would sort of berate her for not doing her art. You know, like, you've got all this talent, you've got a degree in art, and why aren't you doing something more with it? And so I think she was, like, determined, I'll show you, I won't do anything with it. Uh-huh. And so I think that sort of just lasted. She also was, I think, you know, as the older I get, the more I realize that so much in life has to do with your family of origin and your relationships there and so on. And I think she was the second child in a family in which her brother was the golden boy, and he went on and became a big, well-known professor of religion at Columbia and all this stuff. And she was, you know, her parents always felt like, you know, he could do anything, and you know, she could do something, but you know, very domestically oriented mm-hmm. a life. And so she bought into that and pretty much never really shook that off, other than she always said to me, well, you need to go to college and you need to get a teaching degree so that if anything happens to your husband, you can get a job. So I remember that. And I don't think I was terribly I was rebellious, but in other ways. But I don't know that I was rebellious in a really strong intellectual way until later.
Now, were you able to? Did your parents leave it up to you as to where you were going to go to college?
Well, see, at first I was really going to go to the junior college,
oh, yeah.
and mm-hmm. and I was going to go to Centenary Junior College in New Jersey, and my father. Was always saying that I need to go to a four-year school. And I don't know exactly what happened, how the four-year thing came, but it came kind of in my senior year, where it really doesn't make sense for her to go to a junior college and then transfer to a four-year school. She should just go to a four-year school. And I think I was late looking for a school, and And I didn't have any deliberate, intentional plan of how to look for a college. And I went out, I had a date with somebody who went to Ohio Wesleyan. Either he was still there or he had gone there or something. And he said, oh, I think you'd like Ohio Wesleyan. So I had that sort of in my head. And then my mother was big on Worcester College because she wanted me to go to a church-related school. And that was a Presbyterian school, and her brother had taught there briefly in his career. So she said, well, let's go out to Ohio. And this was really kind of late into my senior year, I believe. And she said, let's go look at Worcester and Ohio Wesleyan, because that's a Methodist school. So we went there, and I wasn't too thrilled with Worcester. I remember going on a tour, and I said to the person who was giving us a tour, I said, well, what do people do on the weekends? And he said something like, well, we pretty much, you know, go to the library and whatever. And, you know, I was a big social person at the time, and I thought, that's not for me. So we went on to Ohio Wesleyan, and I liked the campus, and I liked the place. And the amazing thing, though, is that when my mother was there, she contacted, and she had heard from her brother, because she didn't have a very close relationship with her brother, but he was at this point teaching in Claremont in California. And she, I think, maybe let him know that we were going to go to Worcester and we're going to look at his old school there. And also Ohio Wesleyan. And so he contacted her back and said, oh, when you're there, you should look up your old boyfriend, Lloyd Easton, because I believe he's still on the faculty there. And they had been together as a couple in the 30s. And then he had broken up with her and married somebody else. And she totally lost contact with him. So here we are looking at the school. And she contacts him. And he was recently widowed. And, you know, there was some spark there. And my mother was in the process of getting divorced. So they said, well, let's, you know, we went over to the house and I met him and whatever. And then I could tell there was something there between them still. And so then I did get accepted there. And I went to school. I went out there in September. And then she kept seeing him. And then from afar, because, I mean, she's still living in New Jersey, he's in Ohio. I think he had a sabbatical in New York, and so he saw her more. And so then in the beginning of my sophomore year, they were married.
Oh.
So, and they stayed married. You know, they had a really long marriage. 40 years or something.
Huh.
And, you know, if I hadn't in that whimsical way, I think I'll go to Ohio, try out Ohio Wesleyan. I mean, it never would have happened. So it's an amazing romance.
Yes.
It really is. and fortunately, you know, it worked out well.
Now, did it work out well for you? Were you glad you picked that school?
I think so. I think... I wasn't sure if I was going to mention this, Sandy, but I think I'm going to mention it because it's so much a part of me, alas and alack. And that is that, and it's a problem that I only really came to terms with 5 years ago. But I think from the first time I ever had a drink, I had a drinking problem. And it was totally unrecognized by my parents, who drank themselves, although because he was a minister and stuff, that was taboo. And so I think they didn't want to look at my drinking because they were drinking. So I was in this fast-paced New Jersey suburb, and so I was drinking a lot in high school. And again, nothing done about it by my parents. And in college, fortunately, I got through college fine, in the sense that I got into University of Michigan grad school and everything, so obviously my grades were okay. But I think that it was always a factor And, you know, I thought to myself, God, I wish I could just go back, you know, be in high school, be in college, all these times in my life and not have had that burden on me because it was huge. And, you know, I know enough about alcoholism now to know that often, now there's different ways it comes, but often someone will know from pretty much their first drink that they really take to this substance. And I did, and for many reasons, part of it being probably my family situation and so on, but part of it probably just genetic. So that's really kind of affected, that kind of affected me for a long time. I say 5 years ago, actually, in my marriage, it came up as a problem, and for many years of my marriage, fortunately, the critical ones when the children were growing up, I was not drinking. But then when I moved here and was divorced, then I thought, well, I could reinvent myself as a social drinker. And of course, all that time, it had been building up in me, even over all those many years when I wasn't. And so it just got worse. And you know, I was able to handle it well enough to get tenure, and so it, but at the same time, it really, really has had a huge impact on my life. And fortunately, the last 5 years, I have been very seriously in recovery, and I don't intend to talk about this the whole time, but I do feel that it's very much a part of my life. And it's also a part of my life with the university because this department and the university were very supportive of me. And I think that should be sort of in the record. Mm-hmm. And that is that the discovery, the revelation that I had a problem came after I had tenure. And the department gave me a health sabbatical. And I went to treatment, and when I came back from that, they found somebody to take my classes so that they kind of eased things for me. Unfortunately, that in itself was not solve everything, and it took longer than that for me to really take this seriously. But again, the department was very, very supportive. Mm-hmm. And the university, I know that Louise had to work with deans, and they, I'm trying to think of her name, Mary Ann, she was an assistant dean.
Oh, yeah,
Mary Ann. I can't remember her last name, because we used to call her Mary Ann so much, but she was great. And every time that she would see me, she would always be like extra. She knew because she helped to make some of these arrangements, and she'd always give me a hug, and was just and I just feel like that's kind of amazing that that happened. I realized that, you know, since I had tenure, I had a little bit of job security, but at the same time, I know that other universities would not necessarily have been as nurturing. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it was Louise, and a lot of it was the university. So as I said, I don't want to talk about that the whole time, but I had been debating in my mind, Sandy, about whether to bring it up or not. I thought, you know, there's just no way I can not talk about it. I mean, it has had such an effect on my life, such a huge effect. And you know, not all bad. I mean, part of who I am is because of it, and but at the same time, it's just really hard to jump over that little stream there. Although I'm trying not to make it be the only story of my life.
Well, I know there are many more
other stories, yeah. And so because I was looking at your questions, and none of them really seemed too much that where that would come out, and yet I thought, well, you know, it's going to come out. It's just, you know, it can't help but come out because it does affect so much of my life. But I married somebody that I had met at college, and he was an English teacher, and so I became an English teacher, And then...
High school?
My first job was seventh grade English, which is everybody's worst nightmare, which I was totally unprepared for. Not only unprepared for marriage, because I was just a kind of fluky, oh, let's get married kind of thing. But I think my mother was thrilled because that was sort of her end goal anyway. It was always just for me to be married. So dealing with marriage, first year marriage, and then first year teaching seventh grade English. But then my husband moved a lot. I always was trying to work either, it's somewhat the same pattern, I guess, of my father in the sense of, you know, grass greener, and also he was always wanting to be in school and working on another degree. And so we moved kind of according to where he was going to school for degrees, and so I ended up helping him get a PhD at Pitt, and then a divinity, 3-year divinity degree in the Episcopal Church at Suwanee, Tennessee. About 7 years into our marriage, when I was 30, we had our first child, Emily, and then 2 years later, we had Carl. That's when we were living in Atlanta. So we had, just in the sense of chronology, we'd met at Ohio Wesleyan, and then I went to the University of Michigan and got a master's in English there in 1 year. And then I had met, and then Ed and I decided to get married, and so he was teaching in Lake Forest, Illinois, and we got married that summer, and then we moved to Lake Forest, and then I was teaching the junior high, he was teaching in the high school. And then he decided that he wanted to go on for his PhD, and so we moved to Pittsburgh, and I got a job there in a girls' school, and it was just the most wonderful experience. It was a fabulous school, independent school, right in town. I worked there for 5 years, and during that time, I started writing myself. I was doing a lot of creative writing with my classes, but again, not doing it myself. And I started, and then someone asked me to teach creative writing class for seniors, and I thought, that whole summer beforehand, I was thinking, oh, this is horrible, here I'm teaching this class, I'm doing it myself, and so on. And that summer, we were someplace in Canada, and all of a sudden, you know, the first poem came, and then just poem after poem after poem after poem.
I didn't know you were a poet.
Yes, so that was just this wonderful sense, like, actually, I have a creative voice, and I have a talent. I mean, it's not huge, but it's a talent. And so it's always been like a very, very important thing in my life. And sometimes I don't write all the time, and I'm not even in a writer's group or anything, but the way, and of course right now I pretty much still do lots and lots of academic writing, but it affects the way I write, and usually people comment on my writing style, and you know, and I guess it has more of a poetic touch to it. And so that was just huge. And I don't know if, I guess maybe it would have come in some other way if I'd been a secretary or something, but I don't think so. I think it was really the teaching. Mm-hmm. And it was teaching others. And so that was really huge. And when I left that school, the graduating class asked me to be their speaker, and I read some of my poems, and they asked me to read some of my poems. So that was just a real thrill. So then we moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and my husband had a job opportunity. He had finished his PhD by then, and so that's where the kids were born. And I worked for 1 year in a very, very interesting job using creative writing, and that was, I signed up to work for the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta, which is so unlike me because I had just been working at a private school for girls in Pittsburgh, a very privileged place. And I was not working in Atlanta at the time. I was actually waiting to get pregnant, and it wasn't happening right away. So somebody I met said that she was starting up this educational program that was going to be funded by the Atlanta School Board. And did I want to teach an English class there? And so I said, yeah, I think I do. And so it was part-time. And I guess I was supposed to teach like just basic English kind of stuff, but I decided to make it creative writing because I realized that the women, first of all, it wasn't like a GED class. They weren't really, it was just really something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that they'd be in and out, which is common to a jail situation, but that some of them would be in there for longer, and they could maybe try some more ambitious writing. So of course I realized very soon on that, you know, there was huge literacy problems in a lot of, you know, and actually the women who came, I mean, they didn't even have to come, but they, a lot of them just came just because it was something, there was nothing else, there were no other things going on at the time. I would just bring in objects, and we would write about the objects, you know, seashells or old dolls or anything that I thought would evoke a memory, and apples and so on. Security, it was, I think, very different from what it would be today, because I'm not even aware that I had to go through any major security. I stopped working there, so I only did that for a year. But it really, really changed my life in many ways, because I became, I think, more of a feminist. I saw women's issues in a different way. I also realized the power of writing, that it really was liberating. And it was a really powerful experience for me. And one story that I have sometimes shared with students in my storytelling class, we have a component on life stories. And I won't tell the whole story, but I'll just refer to it. And that is that after I stopped working there, I had my first child, Emily, and the women had known that I was pregnant because I had been there. And then about 6 months into my time with Emily, nursing her and tending to her and whatever, I got a phone call, and somebody, the woman who had organized this program, said, well, a lot of these women that we worked with are now sentenced to a federal women's penitentiary in somewhere further into Georgia. I can't remember the name of the town right now. And so she said, we're going to take John there. Now, you know, it's going to probably take about 2 hours to get there, and but I think it's, you know, I think it'd be important, and do you think you can go? And I said, yeah, sure, I can go. And I when I got off the phone, I realized, well, of course that would mean, since I was nursing, that I would be bringing Emily. So they picked me up, and we made this long drive, going across these Georgia highways with all these long, skinny pine trees. And it was a suburban station wagon. I was sitting in the back with Emily, who was nursing and sleeping. And so we finally got to the the prison. And we got into the big all-purpose room, and there was one woman, I was looking for Rita, because this was one woman that I had worked with who really seemed to have some facility with language, and she discovered it in the time that she was working with me. And between sessions, she would be working on her writing, and she would share it with me. But I had totally lost contact with her, and when I had my baby, I really didn't keep up or try to keep up with, or find out more about her. But I knew that she was there. And So we got into this big all-purpose room, and I was looking for Rita, and she was this tall African-American woman, and all of a sudden I saw her across the room, and I was holding Emily, and she came toward me, and she was just beaming because, you know, when she knew me, I was just great with child. Mm-hmm. And so here I am with this baby, and that I had brought the baby, which I didn't even do it, you know, for her, basically. I just did it because of, you know, I was nursing. So she reaches out for the baby, and so she takes Emily. Unfortunately, Emily is one of these child who just loves everybody, who loved everybody. You know, she'd always smile and beam and just, you know, this darling face and everything. And, you know, at 6 months old, they're just so precious.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, all across that room, women started lining up to hold Emily. Hmm. And it was for the first time I realized that these women were women who were mothers just like me.
Sure.
And who had children and whose arms ached to hold them too. Mm-hmm. And so Emily was passed from one set of arms to another.
That's great.
And
that's a great story.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. boy, did that have, you know, such a huge, huge impact on me. And,
sure.
And of course, I've told the story over and over to Emily, and she said, "That's when I became a feminist, Mom." But it really, it was an amazing experience. I feel like in my life, I want to do that again. I mean, I want to have some kind of experience working with women in doing some kind of writing, maybe in some kind of institutionalized setting.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a jail or prison.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had my second child, and then we moved to Detroit for about a year and a half. That was kind of a big struggle because we had been living in the South for a while, and it was hard to adjust to a big northern city. And my marriage was having problems, and I think the drinking was getting increasingly to be a problem. And then we moved to Suwanee, Tennessee, where my husband was going to go to seminary. And so sometime after, I think, the first year, or into the first year, our marriage started to really kind of become unglued. And we separated. I had the children, and then we got back together sometime in his second year. And it was then that I stopped drinking altogether, and did not do so for, I think that was about 1978, and until I moved here I guess it was 92. So for those years, 14 years, I was sober, and we had a good, I think we were able to give our kids a good happy childhood. Our marriage was always not as good as it could be. And, you know, we did try at various times to build it stronger, but eventually I went on for my doctorate because I was doing... Oh, yeah, I'm jumping way too far ahead, but I was hardly ever just a mother. I always had some kind of part-time teaching job because my husband was off in school.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught when we were at Suwanee, Tennessee. I taught at a school there part-time, and I taught part-time at the University of Detroit when we were in Detroit. And then we moved to New Orleans, and we were there for about 5 years, and I worked full time then at an Episcopal school in New Orleans, and that was a good experience, and we all loved New Orleans very much. But then my husband's job was kind of coming apart.
Was he a minister yet?
He was now a minister. Okay. And he had a church that was, he actually took on an all-black church in New Orleans, and it was too much for him. I think he didn't really have the skills to deal with something like that. So in the meantime, I was getting really tired of teaching. I was doing a lot of, at this point I was teaching a school that was a K through 8 school. And I was doing a lot of, there was a lot of discipline stuff. I never really got good at disciplining kids and working with middle school kids. And I was doing a lot of middle school stuff. And I thought, gosh, there's got to be something else I can do with my love of books and writing and so on. And so I decided to become a librarian. And that was largely because when I was at Pittsburgh, there was a wonderful, when I was teaching at that girls' school, Ellis School, there was a wonderful school librarian there. And she just gave me such an example of what a difference a librarian can make. And so that was in my mind. I was the only real librarian that had made an impact on me at all. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I want to be a school librarian. And so I started working part-time on that at LSU, taking classes, going back and forth to Baton Rouge from New Orleans, taking some things there in New Orleans. And then when I finished my degree, I realized that I really didn't think I wanted to go back into the schools. And my horizons had been stretched to the idea that I could do a lot of things with a library degree. And so I was offered a job at the University of Southern Mississippi as an assistant curator of a wonderful collection of children's literature they had there, which was the DeGrummond Collection. And it was a collection that had been built up by this sort of a one-woman collection. This woman built up this collection in the 1960s when she came to the university in her retirement to teach children's literature. And her name was Lena DeGrummond, and she had been head of school libraries for the state of Louisiana. And in that capacity had met lots of writers and illustrators and had brought them into libraries and schools and had seen a lot of their original manuscripts. And she thought, you know, the way you teach children's literature is not through one of these textbooks, but is to see all of their work, their creative work. And so she, on her own, just started writing to people and also traveling around the country and asking, can I stop and see you? And, you know, because she had met a lot of people, so she mm-hmm. knew a lot of people. And, you know, she was sort of like the little old lady in tennis shoes. And of course, people were very flattered. And this was at a time when there really wasn't any interest in collecting this stuff. You know, there wasn't as much respect for children's books at that time anyway, and especially for the creative, the materials in their making, the manuscripts and all of the different illustrative materials. So she started building up this collection, and it was at a time when the university there had some money, and so they kept giving her money, and she started going with this further and further and further. And then finally, when she retired, they named the collection after her, and a curator was hired who wanted to really build up the rare books part of the collection. And so it became, and still is, one of the leading collections of its kind in the country, probably second only to the Curlin Collection at the University of Minnesota. So I was hired to be an assistant curator there, and it really suited me so well because I had already sort of fallen in love with the history of children's literature. I had, when I was working at the school in New Orleans, I had been given a grant to study abroad for a summer, and I had chosen London, and I had taken a course in the history of children's literature. In fact, that's where I met someone from the University of Southern Mississippi, which was my contact then to get that job later. But I realized that I just loved the history. And so so here I was at a collection in which we had fabulous stuff going all the way back to the 15th century and the early 16th century, all the way up, in, with just an amazing collection. And they wanted me to do a lot of outreach activities with the collection and educational work. And the woman who was the curator was kind of very shy, and she was more of a cataloger. And so she really looked to me to be the sort of outgoing part of the collection. And so I did that and really, really liked it. And I was doing a lot of teaching from it, and people kept saying to me, oh, you should go on for your doctorate. You're such a good teacher, and so on. And so I, after a while, thought, well, you know, maybe I will go on for my doctorate. I'll look into it. And, you know, as soon as you start looking, you know, you open that door, it gets wider. And so I thought, well, I'll just apply. I looked around to where I could actually do work in children's literature, and the places were few and far between. And so I, University of Alabama was starting up a PhD in library science, and the I went over there for an interview, and they said, well, you know, I think you would qualify for one of these great federal fellowships and so on, and so, wouldn't you know, I got this really great fellowship. And so I thought, well, I guess that door is open, and I guess I'll do it. Because by that time, my job had changed in nature, and I wasn't doing all this great outreach and development work for the collection. There was a new overall library director who wanted me to be much more just processing manuscripts and being behind the scenes. And I really was, I was never trained as an archivist, and so what they really wanted me to do was to be an archivist, and I just, that wasn't my training or my strength. So I had been more of an urge to go for my degree. So I went to Alabama, and I had taken a lot of English. I had taken my minor in English there at the University of Southern Mississippi before I started. So, and I also got a lot of credit for my master's, which was fairly recent, from LSU. And so I actually was able to do all of my coursework in a year's time. I just took a phenomenal amount of courses, and you know, like five classes each semester. It was just amazing. But I was so motivated. And then I was going back and forth. My husband was at home in Mississippi with the kids. And then I finished that. I knew from the beginning what I wanted to do my dissertation on, because at the collection, the de Grumman collection where I was working, there was this wonderful collection of the works of Kate Greenaway, who was this late 19th century British illustrator and author of some books for children. And we had been given a whole lot of her materials. And I, when I would be looking through her materials, I was always curious, I wonder what the Victorians thought of her work, because it looked very, very sentimental to me and super romantic. And I thought, I wonder, you know, knowing that she was very, very popular in England and America, and actually in France and other places too, I thought, you know, what did they see in her work? And so very innocently, not even knowing that that's actually a research approach, which is reception study, I started just blindly just looking in journals, and I thought, well, I'm gonna maybe write a paper on this and give it at a Popular Culture Association conference. So I did, and I did some research, and I did that at a conference, and then I started doing more. I was always doing little writing on the collection and on other things. And so I was keeping up my writing pretty much. And in fact, that was one reason why I got a really good fellowship to go to Alabama, was because I already had a bunch of publications, and they saw me as somebody who would look like they would be good material for the doctorate, and also for becoming a faculty member. So I was really interested in Kate Greenaway. And so right when I got to Alabama, I tried to shape my assignments toward work on this project and so on, because at the time I wanted to look at her reception in England, America, and France. And my committee advised me not to do the France, since my French was very rusty, and that 19th century French is challenging enough. So I did just the United States and America, and so I took some theoretical lens that were out there in terms of how to do an historical study like this, and I did that. So then when I finished it, I came back to Mississippi, and at this point, my marriage was really coming unglued, because I think all that time that I was away from home working on the degree, and my husband was coping, things were just sort of unraveling between us. So then I came back and basically was facing divorce issues, and also the fact that when I came back, I didn't even have my job in that collection. They had cut back, and that position was no longer there, so I was now given a job at the reference desk in the regular library, which was interesting, and I ended up only doing it for a year because I came here after that, but it was...
Just going to interrupt. Now, sure. Anne, when you were getting your PhD,
yeah.
Were you getting it with the goal of teaching?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to teach children's literature. And so fortunately, the grant that I got, the federal grant, was under for literacy. And so because of children's literature, I qualified for that. And so I came back to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and, you know, my marriage kind of unraveling, not feeling like there was really no prospects for a job, and I was just very, very down and depressed and so on. And I remember I contacted Kathleen Heim, who her name now is Kathleen Heim McCook, and she was a graduate of University of Wisconsin doctoral program. I took pictures out there in the hallway when we have our leaders' pictures. And she was a real influence on my life, because as dean at LSU, she took a real interest in returning women students. She was a very strong feminist and tried to help us. And, you know, I was in my 40s then when I was working on my master's in library science at LSU. And she was always very, very helpful to me and took a real interest in my career and so on. And she also, she would look at women's resumes who had been out of school for a long time and try to shape them in terms of how to market yourself and so on. And she also really pumped into us, right, that is the way to make a difference in this field. So she, I'm not sure if I contacted her or she contacted me or whatever, but somehow we were in contact with each other by phone. And I said, well, I don't think there's any jobs out there, and, you know, I don't know. She said, yeah, of course there's jobs out there, and I'm going to find you one. So she was kind of like the old girl network.
Uh-huh.
So she got on the phone, because she had graduated from here, she got on the phone with Jane Robbins, who was director then, and she said, I think you all are looking for somebody in children's, aren't you? And she said, yeah, we are. And she said, well, I've got this really great person, and, you know, she's, you know, this and that and so on. And so so she opened the door for me. And so then I got a call from Jane Robbins and said, well, you know, why don't you apply and so on. So I did. And then I came out for an interview. And when I came out for an interview, I just felt like things were just so in line for me to get this job. Because they, Wayne Wiggin had been sort of stirring the waters that we need to be more interdisciplinary, that we need to see what fields that we can connect with, and one of them being English with the children's literature. And so the fact that I had a master's in English and a strong background in English, and my writing was pretty much literary history, He was a real booster for my coming, and I think it looked very, very good. And I think the hope was that I would, then a lot of my classes would be cross-lit with English, which just never happened. But there were a couple other people, obviously there were interviewed too, but I felt very encouraged when I was here, and I felt that they were very interested in my research, and I already knew where I was going to take my research from there. And so I was able to talk about that, which is always good. And and Jane Robbins, as the head, was always, when I was here for that weekend, she was always giving me the high sign and just whatever. So I was pleasantly surprised to be offered the job and pleased. And so all of a sudden, here I am from, you know, somebody who had not had a real faculty job and who had been in Mississippi, which most people have that sense that if once you go to Mississippi, you're never going to get out of Mississippi. In fact, I think one of my first experiences when I moved here was, somebody said, "Well, where are you from?" And so I said, "Well, most recently I was living in Mississippi." And the person looked at me dumbfounded, and she said, "I have never, ever met anyone before who came from Mississippi." And so it was really a stark contrast to move to Madison, because even though Hattiesburg for a college town was fairly liberal, fairly for Mississippi terms, but you always had to be watching your step and you know, sort of fitting in and whatever. But to move someplace where you could just proudly be a feminist and liberal politically and so on, it was just great. So I moved here, and
that was in 1992. You said?
I think it was the fall of 93. I think I finished my doctorate in 92. Yeah, I did, in the fall of 92. But then I went back and had that reference job there. And so it was not till the fall of 93 that I came. Mm-hmm. And because I have finished 13 years, so that makes sense. So when I came, I was teaching storytelling and children's literature. And then a course in collection management. And my strengths were always really in the literature part. I mean, I guess in many ways I still see myself as an old English teacher. So in teaching children's literature, I had a fabulous experience that had happened to me during the time that I was in Mississippi, and that is that I received this NEH seminar fellowship to study at Princeton for the summer. And this was with this English professor, Uli Knoflemacher, great name, who was one of the pioneers in teaching children's literature in an English department, and of course in a very prestigious English department. Princeton, and he also had been doing summer seminars with NEH, not all the time, and they were, you know, very prestigious. Only 12 people would be accepted, but I think he was interested in the fact, first of all, that I was at this special collection in Mississippi, and it must have been something in my application or whatever. So I did that, and that really, and he was very encouraging to me, because he would meet with each of us in the seminar and talk about our work and our research and our careers, and he really said, "Oh, you should really go on for your doctorate." And he said, "I think this work you're doing on Kate Greenaway could definitely be a book," and so on. And he looked at, he was kind enough to actually read the latest kind of book out there on her, and he was able to say, "This is what this person does, but this is what this person doesn't do, and you could do this," and so on, which was just amazing. Mm-hmm. And he did that for everybody. And also, I took then the design of this class, because the seminar was in children's literature, and I took that, and then I sort of use that as the model, more or less, for the class that I taught here. And so right away I came in with a very good course in mind, but it was very much a literary class, and that I taught that for in the beginning, semester after semester, and I thought it was very, very good. I really do think my best teaching was teaching that class. Recently, Louise Robbins, the director, has asked me to kind of drop that and do a more contemporary class. The class was hitting a lot of the classics of children's literature, mm-hmm. with some connections to present books, but it being more literary. And she wanted more of a class which would be dealing with contemporary books today and more of the more in line with other sort of library science approaches to children's literature, which have to do more with selection and access issues. Mm-hmm. So I have done that. Last spring I did do a new course, and I presume that in my next 2 years that's what I will be teaching again, and I probably will not be teaching my favorite class again, which is kind of sad, but I do at least have good memories of it being a great class and a successful class. I also was hired to teach storytelling right from the beginning. And storytelling has traditionally been part of library schools, starting way back in this particular library school of Wisconsin, all the way back at a century ago when we started out, we were offering storytelling as either a component of a course on reading or as a separate course. And that is part of what has historically been done in the field, that library science was really the field that took storytelling seriously at the end of the 19th century and started to offer that. And I have to say that one of my strong interests not only is the history of children's literature, but also the history of children's libraries. And one thing that I have done since being here is I have developed real strong research interest in the history of children's libraries. And I was able to see some connections there that happened historically at the end of the 19th century where in the beginning of the 20th century where children's librarians were so powerful as cultural authorities that they were actually impacting the kinds of books that were being published. And I was able to trace some of these connections together and to write about that. So I saw that as early on as a kind of thing that I could do, which came uniquely out of my own perspectives, right. Being much more in the English literary field, and then now approaching this library field almost with new eyes, and then looking to see, aha, things, connections that people were not making, and so on. And my research has really been in the intersection between children's libraries and children's literature at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And that period of basically 1880 to 1920 is very, very interesting to me. And right now I'm working on the kindergarten movement and its influence on children's libraries and its connection to children's literature. And that kind of pulls me back to a lot of my strong interests in education. So now I'm working kind of in the field of education history and trying to pull that into some library history and to literary history. So I think I've always been somebody very interested in the context, really more than the text, the context of literature. And of course libraries play a critical role in that context. So I guess I'll just say a few things about going back a little bit to the tenure process here. I felt very supported in that. The person whose job I inherited had been kind of sloppy in terms of tenure and not paying attention to the help that was offered. And so when I came, and she did not even get really to first base with tenure. So when I came, there was a real sense of, boy, we want to be sure that doesn't happen again. And so there was a lot of nurturing and a lot of evaluation and a lot of help. So I felt very, very well supported. And I was here at a time when there were a lot of strong, the senior faculty were really strong. So there was a number of Wayne Wagon was here and strong, and Darlene Weingan, and Doug Zwizek, and those three were particularly were close and very solidly helping me. And I feel like Wayne Wagon helped me a lot in my career in the sense of bringing opportunities my way for things, whether it was participating in the Center for the History of Print Culture here or for doing publications, whatever, that he also really validated my interests, which I think was really important. I can see myself being in another, perhaps another library school where my interests would have seemed way too academic and historical and esoteric and not have been reinforced. And there would have been perhaps much more of an emphasis on be in the present. Well, my interests were really in the past, and they that was affirmed here, that was important, and that that history was important. So I feel that I was just incredibly lucky to be here, and I've always felt that, that I can't imagine any other school that would have been so receptive to who I am and to what I had to offer. I do feel that the field is changing a lot in terms of its emphasis on technology, and that it's a very different place than where I was 13 years ago.
The field or the school or
the
both?
The field and the school, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there still is respect here at this school for what I do, but at the same time, I think there's always been an expectation that I would become more technological, and in many ways I just stayed as the sort of book person, book woman, and so it's I think it's there's been a little tension there in the department and certainly in my own sense of myself, you know, realizing this and yet not really able to master it or not willing to, whatever.
Have you seen changes in the students over the years that you've been here?
Yes, I have but really I haven't thought about it until you mentioned it, till you asked me, but I said yes right away. So I think that For one thing, we seem to be getting a lot of students right out of university, and that is different because they tend to see this program as just another major, whereas if you get students who have, this is a second career move for them, they're coming here with much more of a seriousness of purpose. Mm-hmm. I think that for a while when I was here, the average age of student was 35, so there were a lot of older students. I think that's less common now, and I think there's a lot of students who maybe they're learning more about the field. I think it's kind of a sleeper field anyway. A lot of people don't really even know that it's out there until they start, maybe get a job at a college library, or maybe they, like me, see a school librarian at work and say, oh, I'd like to do that. But it's not usually like top on somebody's list of what they want to do when they're younger. But I think we have a lot more students who are who were coming here right from the college, and who don't have the same kind of sort of perhaps sensitivity to professional issues, and I find that challenging. I still continue to have very good students. That's always been gratifying, and I tend to attract students from other departments who are interested in, not a lot, but some who are interested in some of the things that I work on, and that's always gratifying. I have a student right now from English who is interested in the cultural formation of the field of children's literature, and that's what my latest book was on, and it's just such a thrill to be able to talk to somebody who actually cares about the things that I cared about and who is reading my book and going over it and talking about it and so on. I realize that I just haven't had a chance to do that very much. And I think that because I haven't felt that people people here were particularly interested in my research, although they were generally supportive of it, I tended to get involved in professional organizations where I found my colleagues. And so I was pretty active in the Children's Literature Association and was on a big award committee for them and was on their board for a while. And that was really gratifying, and actually I think that helped me career-wise a lot, because I was often at the right place at the right time, and people knew that of some interests that I had, and things just happened. And I would say that organization has been the most helpful to me in my career, more so than the American Library Association, because although they have a children's division, that group is not particularly interested in some of the research that I've been doing. And even though part of my last book, and the book was called Constructing the Canon of Children's Literature Beyond Library Walls and Ivory Towers, and it looks at the sort of cultural formation of the field and looking at the part that librarians played and the part that English people played, and how they kind of used the classics as a way to create their own cultural authority and validation. And I think I have a lot of insights in there about our book orientation as a field, the way we went in that direction versus being more child-centered, and the way that we latched on to awards. And I have a lot of insights in that, which I actually tried to get. I wrote a piece that would go into our professional magazine for children's librarians, and it was turned down, and it really kind of hurt, because I realized that my professional field of library science and children's literature, they're not interested in what I had to say. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, there is this other area, which the International Children's Literature Association, which I have been active with, and they are really interested in that. And they're interested in social critique of the field, and I don't see that children's librarians are interested in that, any kind of critique. Mm-hmm. So
that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. It is. So I feel kind of like I feel very much like a loner in that area. And let's see, in terms of the university, I think as soon as I got tenure, I've always been interested in the workings of the university. Mm-hmm. Coming from a small university, University of Southern Mississippi, coming here to this large university, I realized the only way I was ever going to meet anybody beyond our department was if I volunteered to do things and whatever. So I always was somebody that said yes to everything, you know, faculty senate, sure, being a faculty advisor for the advising center. Sure. I mean, I took on lots and lots of stuff, and I really do think it helped me in tenure, to tell you the truth, because some of those people from the organizations in which I had been active wrote me wonderful letters, like, uh-huh. Oh, she's great, and we really need her at this university. So that didn't hurt. But I have continued, I think in the last several years, I realized, especially because it's just Louise and myself here as senior faculty, that we need to set a model for the junior faculty, and that is that, particularly after you get tenure, then you start to devote a lot of your attention to the university. You start to pay back the university in some ways. And I really see that, not only because of the way the university has been personally supportive to me, but I also just think that that is what is required. So I am, I've never had, I guess it's been the advising center that I have been the most active with, and I'm on the steering committee for the advising center, the LNS advising center in Ingram Hall. And so once a week I go there and I do some advising of freshmen, but I also am on the steering committee and do other activities. There's about four of us on there that are more far-ranging, that go beyond that. And that's, I guess that's been where I've been the most active.
You were on the library committee, weren't you, Anne?
Yes, I'm still on the library committee. In fact, I'm chair of the library committee this last year and this year. Mm-hmm. So that's been exciting, as there's been a lot going on in the library, and it's been wonderful to work with Ken Frazier. And this year I'll be working with Ed, and that'll be good too. So that's been a real...
So it's not a burden?
No, it's not at all. Actually, people in the library...
Well, I didn't mean the library
no.
specifically, but
no.
this
Oh,
this
just
kind of
overall,
work.
No, I haven't felt it to be. And I guess that's because I'm still sort of in awe of the big university, and I feel like I'm going to leave here in 2 years, and I still will feel like I hardly know anybody, which, it's sort of sad, but I think we're a small little department, and I don't know how people meet other people other than getting involved in some organizations, which I have. But for example, you can be a faculty senator, and that doesn't mean you're going to actually meet anybody. You're going to see people stand up and talk and so on, but you're not going to be working closely with them. And I think it's only really when you're on a very close basis working with people that you actually get to know them. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how many how many opportunities are out there for people in the university like that. I am on several committees in which, I say a little something, particularly if it's all library oriented. I'm on the archives committee, and then I'm on the library committee.
Would you talk a little bit about the climate for women on the campus? Do you think it helps or hinders women in advancing?
Yeah. Well, I would say it's been very helpful. And I guess I'm just looking at it personally. For me, I have never felt diminished because of my gender here at all. I've never, and a lot of that is, of course, I'm in a very feminized field, and in a department with a lot of women or men who are clearly feminists too, or they wouldn't be in this field. So, or they wouldn't be in this school, this department. So I have felt very supportive. I have nothing but praise for the university in terms of that. And at one point, I got a salary increase that came because Louise went after it for me, but because it was a women's inequity kind of thing, and my salary was pretty low. So I feel like everything that I've wanted to do at the university has always been affirmed. So I feel very lucky. I feel very lucky.
There's one more question
Okay. Before
we talk about your life after work.
Oh, sure.
You had talked earlier about a couple of what I would consider very
important fellowships and important to your mm-hmm. career. Are there other honors or awards that you've received that you'd like to talk about?
Not that I can think of particularly. I was elected to, some important committees like the Newbery Award Committee and the Caldecott Committee and the Phoenix Award and the Hans Christian Andersen Award. And so those were all important, important things to for me in achievement and elected to the board of the Children's Literature Association. But no, I can't really point to anything. Since graduate school, I received that federal fellowship, and also the second year I got one of the very few dissertation awards that the University of Alabama gave. Mm-hmm. But since then, I'm not really in a field that is related to grants, unfortunately. there just really doesn't seem to be. I have gotten some things through the university in terms of summer grant and I think that the NEH is always somewhat of a possibility out there, and one year my application was received a good hearing from NEH, but no, I really don't feel that I have been lauded in that way, which, it's okay.
Well,
I look at my life, I think, very differently than the way maybe some other people do. I have different sense of priorities and a different sense of survival and achievement.
Well, that's a good introduction into this final question.
Okay.
Life after work.
Okay.
You talk about your family and how you balance your work and family,
yeah.
What you do for fun and relaxation,
okay.
How you keep healthy and energetic.
All right. Well, that's one to talk about. My children are really a delight in my life. My daughter is 31, Emily, and my son is Carl is 29. He's a musician and she's a writer, and I have a very, very close relationship with them, one where we're, every week in contact with each other, either by email or phone, and keep in really close touch and are very supportive of each other through our life struggles and our joys.
And you said your mother is still living?
Yes, and she's 90, and I'm leaving on Wednesday to visit her for a week, and she's doing really well.
Is she in New Jersey? Or?
No, she's still in Delaware, Ohio, where she moved many years ago
for
me to go to college.
Yeah.
And she lives in this wonderful intergenerational dormitory, which is just one of a kind. I don't know of any place else that has this, something like this. And so she, there's some college students in there, and there's middle-aged people, and there's some older people, and it's just amazing. And so everybody has their own apartments. I know. And she can go to the university and for classes and whatever, but she doesn't take advantage of that. But it's a great place. It's this sort of old, elegant dormitory from the 1920s, a big old brick colonial. And
private?
Well, it's privately managed, but it's through the university.
Oh,
yeah, it's just great. So it's, as I said, I think it's just the ideal place.
Mm-hmm.
It's not assisted living. I mean, it's just really a residence hall. But there are a number of elderly people that live there and realize that this is great, and they kind of have cocktail hour every night, and they support each other. They have little potlucks and do things together and so on. So she's got really a community there,
mm-hmm.
which is great. Before that, she was living on the country, which wasn't so great. But so I'm really close with my mother, and she's doing really well. And for the last 4 years, I've been with my partner, Tom Lovett. And the last 2 years we've been living together, and we're talking about marriage. So,
what does he do?
He's retired. He's been retired for about the last 10 years from the state. He worked in the budget office and also in the Medicare office as, I guess, a bureaucrat, as he says, but he was always a writer. And so he, when he got enough of his years in to retire, he retired and has been kind of writing ever since. And so we have a lot of interests in common in terms of writing and nature and family and travel and so on. And we live right over by the Arboretum, and so I get to walk in there every day. And so I have a very, very good life, and I feel like every day is a privilege and a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any pets?
No, no pets. Few allergies I have.
Oh.
So I'd love to have them, but I kind of resist. So.
Well, that's the end of our questions.
Yeah,
this was a great interview. If there's anything else you want to say.
No, I feel this has been great.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sandy, for